It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about a special report on the health and water quality of the Milwaukee River Basin.
First, it's been less than a week since a federal judge struck down Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage, and already a number of counties around the state have started granting marriage licenses to couples seeking them.
Dane and Milwaukee counties were two of the first to begin issuing licenses, but our next guest says the list of counties marrying gay couples has grown to be a long and politically diverse one, ranging from big to small, urban to rural, and very blue to very red.
To put it all in perspective, we have Craig Gilbert with us. He's Washington Bureau Chief at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be with you.
So how many counties at this point in Wisconsin have started granting marriage licenses to same-sex couples?
Well, at the end of the day, yesterday, it was 50 out of the 72. I think that number may have gone up even a little bit more. What was interesting about it was when I started looking at this, I thought, you know, here we had a great kind of natural experiment where, you know, unusually, these counties were left to sort of decide for themselves by the court ruling, you know, whether to grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And when I started looking at it on Monday, it looked like we kind of had a set of counties that were kind of Democratic tilting that were granting licenses and another set that were Republican tilting that weren't. But as the list grew and grew and grew, the real story became something else, which is that, you know, all kinds of different counties, very Republican counties, very Democratic counties, very urban counties, very rural counties, counties in all parts of the state were on the list, were among the counties that were marrying gay couples, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, leading up to this, there was a thought that if the ruling overturned the ban and there was no stay, Dane County and Milwaukee County would start issuing licenses. So I don't think anybody was surprised when that happened. But we see counties like Waukesha County among the first. What can you tell us about Waukesha County's politics?
Well, Waukesha is arguably the most Republican county of its size in America. It's certainly the most important Republican county in Wisconsin. But, you know, same-sex marriage is one of those issues that doesn't seem to be conforming to the really sharp, polarized political lines that we see other issues like, for example, health care follow. And so the fact that Waukesha County is very, very Republican and a very conservative county may not, you know, be predictive in this case. I mean, you had the other two counties next door that are also very Republican, Ozaukee and Washington, decline to offer marriage licenses to gay couples. But Waukesha was out of the gate pretty early, which surprised a lot of people. But again, you know, when the dust settled, you had almost as high a percentage of Romney counties, you know, taking this step as you did of Obama counties in Wisconsin. So while there were some differences in the politics, you really had, I think the bigger story, like we said, is that you really had all kinds of counties taking this step. And these are elected officials, county clerks, who are making these decisions, obviously with legal input, but making these discretionary decisions. And you can't help but think that the politics and political attitudes in their counties has some effect on that. And to me, this sort of reinforces the notion that gay marriage is increasingly accepted.
Well, Waukesha County, one of the state's more populated counties behind some of the more directly urban ones. How about, you know, populated versus lower population counties? How did that shake out in the decision so far?
Well, there is, you know, I think this is, if you look at the polling, this is one of those issues where urban-rural may be as important a factor as Democratic or Republican. And in the polling that Marquette did last month, which showed, you know, 55% to 37% support for allowing gay couples to marry, the one media market where people where there was more opposition than support for letting gay couples marry was Wausau-Rhinelander up north, the more rural northern market. So there is something to that, that I think in smaller counties and more rural counties you're going to find less support and maybe somewhat more conservative attitudes about same-sex marriage. But again, a lot of counties that fit that description were doing this as well. We're taking the same step that Milwaukee and Dane County were taking.
You mentioned Waukesha County as a Republican stronghold that is issuing licenses. Are there reverse stories, traditionally Democratic strongholds, where the clerk has decided not to issue same-sex marriage licenses?
Well, there were initially, but pretty much by Tuesday, you really couldn't find a county like that. The 12 counties that gave Obama, President Obama, his biggest margins in Wisconsin in 2012 all took the same step. They didn't all take it at the same time, but again, by the end of Tuesday, every one of those very Democratic counties was issuing marriage licenses to gay couples that wanted them.
You mentioned the Marquette poll on this issue, and you printed a lot of the breakdowns on that. One of the most striking differences on there was generational. Very strong youth support for same-sex marriage. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and this is where you do see really dramatic generational patterns, is this particular issue where you could find younger voters who are Republican and more conservative, but still have a more, you know, quote, liberal, unquote, attitude about gay marriage. And so the age spectrum, as you go up the age spectrum, as people get older, you're going to find less support for gay marriage, although even the older age groups, it's still, you know, kind of 50-50, but particularly among younger voters. The other interesting fault line there is religion and church attendance, where it pretty much, you know, the more frequently you attend church, the less likely you are to support same-sex marriage.
So this is a politically divided state, we often say, on a lot of issues. Is this one issue where you see going down the road, we're not going to be so divided on, and maybe we'll still fight, but we're going to fight about other things?
Yeah, absolutely, because it crosses some of the political, partisan lines. I mean, there are some issues that very much adhere to partisan lines. Again, the most extreme example of that is Obamacare, where pretty much, you know, if you're a Republican, you're against it, and you're for Democrat, you're for it. But this is the other kind of case where whether you're a Republican or Democrat, you know, obviously Republicans are less supportive, but when you look at some of these other sort of demographic fault lines, they're a lot blurrier. And again, generationally, we know that younger voters are more social, are more liberal or moderate on social issues, whether they are Republicans or Democrats. And I think that's what you're seeing here.
It's been just, what, 18 years since the state passed the constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage, which already...
Eight years.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wow, I'm really blurring my math there. Yeah, I reached way too far back. 8 years. So anyway, a big support in the state for that ban, constitutional amendment in place. 8 years later, the polling seems to be in the opposite direction. Do things usually change that fast?
No, it's really surprising for things to change that fast. I mean, it was interesting when some people were surprised in 2006 when the referendum was decided by as big a margin as it was. I mean, I think the same year Arizona had a referendum on a similar issue and went the other way, and Arizona is a more Republican state than Wisconsin. So I think it was a reminder that, you know, there are some conservative strains culturally in Wisconsin that maybe people discount a little too much. But to have, and this is not just Wisconsin where the attitudes have shifted dramatically in recent years, we're very indicative of, very reflective of a national, sharp national change on this particular issue. I mean, if you go back to that point in time we're talking about, a lot of Democratic elected officials were not supporting gay marriage. They were either didn't support it because of their personal feelings, or they were afraid to support it.
And now we're seeing some Republican elected officials. I'm thinking of Dale Schultz, outgoing senator, who was a co-sponsor of the initial ban on same-sex marriage, saying he's changed his mind since then. Some conservative columnists, they apparently are following the tide of public opinion there.
Yeah, and I think just as significant as that is not, I mean, I think a lot of other Republican politicians fall into a slightly different category, which is they may not be to the point yet where they're explicitly supporting it, but they're not going to speak out against it. They're not going to fight it. They're not going to spend political capital on it. And that's also just as significant.
Is this going to be in any way an election issue this year in Wisconsin? Of course, governor's race, attorney general's race, legislative races around the state.
Interesting. I mean, I think it's a little tricky for Scott Walker because, you know, he's got all sorts of considerations. He's got his, you know, he's up for re-election as governor. He's also got to think about his national standing with conservative voters if he wants to run for president in 2016. So he's got some, you know, kind of cross current pressures to consider in his own position on this issue, and it's a little tricky for him, you know, whether how explicit he wants to be in terms of his views on this and where he wants to come down. And we've seen, you know, even today that the state is now administratively processing these licenses, whereas they weren't before. So the politics, I think, are tricky for Governor Walker. I don't think, you know, it's an issue that he wants to be have a high profile in the campaign, but it may be one that is brought up by different candidates and by Democrats at different times.
Craig, you're a numbers and data guy. The way this story went down, it gave you some unexpected data points. What are you going to be watching for going forward?
Well, I mean, we've been talking about the governor's race. I think that's a really rich subject. We've got now a ton of polling data through the Marquette Law School going back to the beginning of January 2012, a massive amount of data that we can mine when it comes to sort of, you know, how different groups of voters are breaking down in this race. Also, you know, how many people are crossing over. You know, the recall, you know, had this fascinating phenomenon where some people were supporting both President Obama and Scott Walker, and what's happened to those people. Turnout is going to be a fascinating discussion because we know the turnouts are different in midterms than in presidential years, and that's going to have a lot to do with the outcome of the governor's race. So there's a lot to look at.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
That's Craig Gilbert. He's Washington Bureau Chief at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're taking a look at a special report on the bodies of water in the Milwaukee River Basin. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel just released a 4-part series on the health of those waters. The Milwaukee River is apparently cleaner and more economically valuable than it has been in about 100 years, but it still faces a lot of challenges.
Lee Berquist joins us now. He's an environmental reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and one of the authors of the report. Lee, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's great to be back.
Well, let's start off by getting a sense of the waterways we're talking about. Which rivers are involved, and where do they flow through?
Well, we're talking about the Milwaukee, the Menominee, and the Kinnickinnick rivers. And we in the Milwaukee area generally refer to that as the Milwaukee River Basin. The Milwaukee starts way up as far as the southern reaches of Fond du Lac County and Sheboygan County as well. You wouldn't know it at all from the river you see when you're in downtown Milwaukee. It's quite pastoral, quite agrarian. Some reaches of it there are trout in them, trout streams, and then the character slowly changes as you move to the south. The Menominee starts in kind of north and west of Milwaukee a little bit. It goes right past Miller Park and then moves upward to the north and to the west a bit. And then the Kinnickinnick comes from a little bit to the southeast, just a few miles, and then they all meet in downtown Milwaukee before they empty out into the harbor and into Lake Michigan.
How would you describe the overall health of these waterways involving the Milwaukee River Basin today?
Well, I think when you say the overall health, then you'd have to say that it is it's better than it used to be, but there still is more work to be done. And it really is a different picture in different parts of the river. And I think that is true in many urban areas, but there are some spots that are doing quite well and others that are quite troubled.
Now, you talked about the past being more problematic in terms of the health of these rivers. What kinds of issues were we looking at historically? What kinds of things were polluting the rivers?
Well, I mean, it was a great place back when Native Americans were here. And then the Menominee River was a vast wetland where it's now the Menominee Valley. But as we became industrialized, we really used, like many cities, we used the river as our sewer, and everything was dumped into it from factories and from our homes, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but historian John Gerda had written a passage that we used in our series that basically talked about how, animal waste and parts of animals and anything you could think of was just dumped right into the rivers. And that's what really started to change the character of it. But when I say that, still in the 20s and the 30s, the Milwaukee River on the north side near Riverside Park was really a playground for people that couldn't get up north. The river people were still swimming in that river, using it as a recreational playland. And just over time, all of that pollution began to take its toll on the rivers.
How important would you say these waterways are to Southeast Wisconsin today?
Oh, I think today, particularly, well, they all are from an ecological perspective. But if one was to talk about it from an economic perspective, the Milwaukee is, and the Menominee especially, are quite important. In our series, we reported that the value of property on the Milwaukee right along the river increased 150% between 2001 and 2013. That added more than $520 million in value to the property tax base. Well, that compares to the city as a whole during that same period, a little over a decade, of about 44%. That river, the Milwaukee River, has been just a magnet for development.
And let's go back and look at when things began to turn around a little bit. The Clean Water Act of 1972, how did that begin to change things for the Milwaukee River Basin?
Well, it changed things because it really gave the force of law for the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the DNR to require that stuff that we just emitted into the water had to be limited in some way. And primarily that came from sewage treatment plants and from factories. And there was vast restrictions on how much on the limits of what people could put in those waters without treating it. And so those pollutants have been sharply reduced since 72, and it wasn't like overnight. This was something that has taken time to do, with literally billions in investment in infrastructure to reduce these pollutants that are discharged into the river.
And what pollutants are we talking about here primarily?
Well, I guess bacteria. Many forms of bacteria are one big measure. The fecal coliform is one that we talk about a lot in the series. Nitrates, which is a form of nitrogen that comes from farm chemicals. Or from farm chemicals, but I guess from what's been reduced, a lot of it has been bacteria has been the main one of the main areas of reduction. And then on a separate front, a lot of the toxic chemicals that were used in manufacturing PCBs, for example, they were restricted, they were banned from use, so that they could no longer be used in industrial processes. And then, since that time, there's been projects on both the Milwaukee and the Kinnickinnick to remove certain areas, big swaths of that on the bottom of the rivers in certain areas of the two rivers.
And so despite the progress that has been made with the Clean Water Act that went into effect 1972, just over half the waters in the Milwaukee River Basin, they're still failing some water quality tests. What are the flashpoints that really need to be addressed here as we go forward?
Well, I think there's a couple of them. One is road salt. When we did this series, we looked at water quality data from the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. It does the most thorough testing of water quality on the three rivers of any of any entity in the region. We looked back at that for the last 30 years, and while you see ups and downs with various measures of pollutants, without a question, road salt has gone up during that time.
And we're going to pause there and come back and keep talking about some of the challenges facing the Milwaukee River Basin. We're talking to environmental reporter Lee Berquist about the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel special series, Rivers Reborn.
And we want to hear from you. What would you like to see done to improve the waters in the Milwaukee River Basin? Have you been watching the progress of the river for years, maybe decades? What have you seen change? Call in and let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
We're picking up our conversation on the health of the waters in the Milwaukee River Basin with environmental reporter Lee Berquist.
And you can join the conversation. What would you like to see done to improve the waters in the Milwaukee River Basin? Have you noticed an improvement in water quality in those rivers? If you're outside of the Milwaukee area, is there a similar story to tell in your part of the state? Call in and let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org.
And before we went to the news, Lee, we were talking about the Kinnikinnick River and some of the difficulties there battling pollution. What are some of the efforts being taken to get that river back in cleaner health?
Well, with the KK, as we call it here in Milwaukee, or the Kinnikinnick, I think the one was a project that was completed a couple of years ago to I think about $10 million to remove polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, from the river at about First Street. That is something that will have some help to the river in the long term. The best thing, and there's also been a project to remove a lot of the concrete that lined the KK River upstream, and by return it to a more natural style of river. Besides that, I think for the KK, the most important thing to do is to do anything that will slow down the non-point pollution, or the kinds of pollution that washes off the ground and eventually into storm sewers and into the rivers. Anything that can be done and is being done to reduce that amount, that type of pollutant, will make that river better, and that's kind of what planners are trying to do.
Let's go to the phones now. We have a call from Dave in Barton. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I was involved in the removal of the Barton Dam back in the early 90s. I was on the town board, and at the time, the town board had chosen to ignore the DNR request to do something about either improving the dam or getting rid of it. And it was very cost-effective to get rid of it, and since then, the people that live in that general area are a lot happier that the fishing has improved, the water quality is better, and it's not just the stagnant mud hole up there anymore.
All right. Thank you for your story, Dave. And that's something that's been happening in the Milwaukee River Basin, the removal of dams. How has that been playing out?
Well, dam removal is always political. On the Milwaukee there's been a dam removed in West Bend, and another one at Lime Kiln in Grafton. But in downtown Grafton, they've kept a dam there. There's still another dam that they've kept in Thiensville, but they have a beautiful fish passage around that whole dam, where if you go on the website of Ozaukee County, you can see photos. They have photos as fish come through that fish passage, and you wouldn't believe the fish that are moving up that river. And then in Milwaukee right now, there's a big debate about the Esterbrook Dam, and whether that should be demolished or it should be repaired. And in each instance, there's almost inevitably been a fight with every case. water quality does seem to improve when this does happen, that's for sure. I guess the North Avenue Dam is the best example in Milwaukee, where that was dammed up, and then when the dam was removed, it's really transformed that section of the river on the east side and near north side of Milwaukee.
Now I want to move to some of the solutions that are being proposed. There are a few different aspects here. One of them is using green projects to capture the runoff that's coming into these rivers. What kinds of projects are being looked at so far?
These are projects mostly that would be like green roofs or swales or vegetation that's planted near streets and alleys, and then some are more elaborate, where parking lots are been retooled to capture all of the water and then reuse that water for a later time. There's people that are talking about, and this has not yet happened, but talking about using a lot of the water from a building and that comes off the building and reusing it again for watering of plants and so forth. This is something that is just, we've been doing it for some time, but it's going to, I think, in the next decade, really become a much bigger part of I guess, a remedy to clean up our rivers.
And another thing that's being looked at is ending state law exceptions that allow, in some cases, for more water pollution to be allowed.
Yeah, they're called variances, or they're exceptions to this in state law that, for example, in downtown Milwaukee, you can have higher oxygen and you can have higher levels of dissolved oxygen and bacteria in the water, and that was probably a very good good rule at one time, because there was no way that the rivers were going to meet that standard, years ago. But as things have improved, in many cases they can meet those standards. And so what environmentalists are arguing is that we should give those areas a more stringent standard now, so that then those who emit water into the system, factories, the sewage district, and others, will have to have a restrict a little bit about, they also will be held to a higher standard as well.
Now, Lee, earlier you mentioned that people had been playing and recreating in general in waterways that were pretty polluted. Is that still the case? Is it safe to play in a lot of these rivers now that we're talking about? Or is there more work that needs to be done?
Well, there's more work that needs to be done, but I mean, there are certainly in downtown Milwaukee on a hot summer night, there can be scores, if not hundreds, of boats that people are motoring up and down the river and out into the lake, and there is now a kayak company that people are kayaking up and down the river all summer long. The Milwaukee Rowing Club has been rowing for decades on that river, but certainly those who are rowing today are rowing in a much cleaner river than the 60s or 70s. But swimming, I don't see anybody doing backstrokes on the Milwaukee River at this point right now.
Not ready yet.
No.
All right. Lee, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Lee Bergquist, environmental reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
It's finally warm enough for boaters to get out on the water again, and that's where our next guest comes in. His passion for boat building and restoration has taken him to the East Coast and Norway for training, and home again to Wisconsin, where he set up J.W. Swan Boat Works.
Josh Swan joins us now. He lives and works in Ashland. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Josh, when did you know that you first wanted to spend your life building and restoring wooden boats?
Well, It's kind of an embarrassing story, really, when I reflect back on it. Growing up, I had a real interest in woodworking, and I guess specifically hand tool woodworking. And sometime in high school, I discovered the music of Stan Rogers. I probably listened to way too much Stan Rogers. And he was a Canadian folk singer and kind of stuck pretty close to the themes of wooden boats and the maritime provinces and sort of life on the water. And so after high school, I looked at trying to figure out a way to turn that interest into a trade or a vocation. And so I moved out to Newport, Rhode Island, and enrolled in a two-year boat building program, and I guess with some awfully romantic notions. So it's a little silly when I reflect back on how I got into it.
So you listened to a lot of the Mary Ellen Carter, huh?
Exactly. And now, for better or worse, my oldest son is now, I don't think my wife's too excited, but he's getting very into Stan Rogers, albeit from, no pressure from me. So.
No shame there. He's a good musician. Well, how do you train for something like wooden boat restoration? It seems like something that, in today's modern age of fiberglass and high-tech stuff, wooden boats are something of a throwback. How do you train for that?
Well, I mean, I suppose they are. I mean, I guess in the big picture of, let's say, recreational boating, wooden boats represent a really small percentage of that. But kind of within that context of the wooden boat industry, it's pretty thriving right now. And so where I was, where I spent 2 years in Rhode Island, it was an opportunity to learn a little bit about a lot of different things. It was where I was, it was kind of an amalgam of a school, museum, working shipyard, and they just kind of, we just tried to, especially with restoration, everything can be a little bit different. And so, as I tell people, I know, more than some and less than others. It's definitely one of the things I like about it is that I feel like I'll always know less than more. It's a really exciting field to be in.
Well, what's special to you about working specifically with wooden boats?
Well, I mean, wood feels pretty intuitive to me. A couple of species globally, it's naturally buoyant. And so I feel like it makes sense to make a boat out of wood. And I think people look at them as these kind of real mysterious things because there's no straight lines. But honestly, it's very logical. I mean, the sort of the lineage of boat building, I mean, these guys were, foresters, loggers, farmers. I mean, it's a really elegant form of logic, and there's a lot of, it just feels very intuitive.
One of the things you did, aside from training in Rhode Island, is you went to Norway to study boat building. What did you learn there?
I had a fantastic time in Norway. And actually, one of the things that I, enjoyed most was the shop that I was in it was very kind of an anachronism in that it was almost pre-industrial. So we were using just a minimal edge tools. And I found that after kind of a fall in that shop, prior to that, I'd actually had a few sort of health scares, just being around fine dust and rotten wood and the fine dust of rotten wood, but it's really healthy. I mean, you've got there's no fine dust in the air, and you're just, I was dealing with kind of big chips, and it felt really good on a lot of levels. Kind of most basically, it was just, I'd end the day, and it felt just really, like I said, just really healthy.
Now, you've worked on quite a few boats by now. You've built some, you've restored some. Can you tell us about a project that's been especially dear to your heart?
Well, I've had a couple of really neat opportunities to work in a public setting, and so one of those was I was able to work up at a museum up in upstate New York in the Adirondack Mountains, and I really have enjoyed the situations where I can build a boat, but where the process is as much of a goal as the result. And so I get to disseminate information and talk to people about boats and explain, what I'm using, but also sort of why, I'm building what I'm building or why this boat exists. And so when I've been in those situations where I get to talk with the public about what I'm doing, that I get to talk about wooden boats. I mean, that just feels like a really great job description.
And I heard you also worked on a 90-year-old boat that was once commissioned by the Norwegian royal family.
I did. Yep, that was a racing sloop, and it had been designed by a Norwegian yacht designer named Johan Anker, and it had been built in Norway to celebrate the city of Oslo, kind of returning to the country of Norway in the mid-20s. And through a variety of circumstances, the boat ended up in Michigan, and it was kind of by proximity, and it ended up in my shop, and where I, you know, it was basically a complete rebuild, and then it's actually been shipped back overseas.
Mm, what did it look like when it was done?
Sleek, very fast. It was a boat that was designed to go really, really fast and be right on that edge of failure. I mean, everything was really lightly built. It was pretty challenging.
Do you take a lot of your own boats out onto the waters of Lake Superior?
Well, if I had more time to build and work on my own boats, I suppose I would. I did build for our family just a little center console outboard skiff. We've got a little rowboat and a wood canvas canoe. But quite frankly, it's a little frustrating to be so close to the lake and yet not get on it more.
So you live close to the shores of Lake Superior. You're in Ashland. Does that inform the kind of boats that you work on and the boats that you build, as opposed to, say, if you were plying your craft on the shores of the Atlantic Ocean, for example?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, especially, I'm moved into my own shop that I've built on our property, and so I'm really excited to have kind of the space in my schedule to start building more new construction. That's really kind of fits the type of waters that are around here, both on Lake Superior and inland. And certainly, and kind of dovetailing into that is also there's a lot of great boat building timber in Wisconsin. So trying to use construction styles that really incorporate wood that I can get, fairly locally.
And how are wooden boats different when you take them out on the lake?
Well, for one thing, they're quiet. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of being in, say, an aluminum canoe or a rowboat,
yeah,
and banging an oar or a paddle against it. It's really loud. Wooden boats, wood is an insulator, and so you don't get that kind of loud noise. And also, because it's an insulator, they're never quite, too hot or too cold. So, say, on a cold day, they feel pretty warm to be inside. And on a really hot day, there's really no better place to take a nap than, on the inside of a wooden boat. It just sort of feels like you're in a, leaning up against a bench in a sauna.
So you think Stan Rogers would be excited if he were still with us to learn that he'd inspired a boat builder from Wisconsin?
I think so. Maybe his son Nathan is listening to this, and he's excited for his father. So, yeah, no, I don't always admit that, but that's kind of, I suppose how I got into all of this.
Well, thanks for sharing it with us. Josh, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking to Josh Swan. He restores and builds wooden boats at JW Swan Boatworks in Ashland.